Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Swimsuit? Check. Sunscreen? Check. Phone charger? Check. Don't forget to pack the 5-Hour Energy. It fits great in a pocket or carry-on, and the alert feeling will help you arrive ready for anything. Now get 20% off when you use code 5HETRAVEL at 5HourEnergy.com. Expires April 30th. One-time use only. Not valid with other discounts. Remember, visit 5HourEnergy.com and use code 5HETRAVEL to save 20%.
Hello everyone and welcome to another episode of Hidden Histories. Today I spoke to Rebecca Riddle. Rebecca is a great friend, a great historian, and she also goes over and above what is expected to provide fantastic history content to everybody. Her festival, HistFest, was unfortunately postponed due to coronavirus, but she went online. So it's available now on YouTube if you want to have a look at that. And she does tell you a little bit about that in the podcast, but also it's going to be live again in September. Rebecca spoke to me about the 1666 Great Fire of London, the devastating fire that is the most famous fire in our time. I hope you enjoy the podcast. Rebecca Riddle. Hello, welcome to Hidden Histories.
Hello, thank you for having me.
We've been talking about doing this podcast for so long and it's taken us to get into a period of isolation where we're actually like, right, let's do it.
Yep.
So we're going to talk about the Great Fire of London in 1666, which is one of three parts of your book, 1666, Plague, War and Hellfire.
Mm-hmm. The end point.
So what was London like in 1666? What did it look like? And what was the context of the time?
So London in 1666 was a city that was recovering from the Great Plague, which had obviously happened the year before, but then it had kind of spilled into that year as well. It was a city of three parts. There was the main heart, which was the city of London, which was and then there was the second part, which was the suburban sprawl, I suppose, that was surrounding this walled central city. And then there was also the city of Westminster, which was to the west, linked by the Strand as well. So there's three components to this city. It's the metropolis as a whole has got a population of between 400 and 500,000 people, and in the City of London, which is the part that was mainly affected by the Great Fire of London, this is an area that's controlled by the mayor, the aldermen and the city guilds. And as I say, it was within this part of the city that the fire broke out.
What did it look like? Because London looks very different today as to how it did in 1666. What were the buildings like?
So this was a city that had timber framed buildings. It was a wooden city, mainly the city of London, and there had been a dry and hot summer during the summer of 1666. So this had made the all of the buildings, as I say, very dry, basically turned the entire area into tinder. So people lived in close proximity to one another. Buildings were very ramshackled. So large buildings that had been built maybe 50, 60, 70 years before had been turned into tenements and split up and divided. So there were people living in homes and attaching little sheds to the side. It was a very, what's the word I'm looking for, oppressive environment. You could walk through the entire city and not realise that it was daylight above.
Yes, it was that sort of very much medieval construct and long winding streets and houses that leaned in quite close to each other. Is that right?
Yeah, that's a better description than the one I've just given. So yes. Yes.
So where did the fire start and how did it spread?
Well, the fire broke out famously in the bakehouse of a man called Thomas Farriner, who was a baker, as the title suggests. And he worked for the Navy. England was at war at this time, so he'd been providing ship's biscuit, as they called it, to the Navy before this point. It broke out between, well, just after midnight, around one-ish, in his bakehouse. There were lots of arguments, and there were lots of arguments at the time as to who was directly responsible. Was it him? Was it his daughter who'd left the coals on inside the oven? But in any case, it doesn't really matter for the purposes of the story. The fire broke out. It took hold of his house, quickly spread down Pudding Lane, and then spread further still down towards the river along Thames Street, which was a place that was almost made for burning. It was full of oily imported goods like fish and also things like alcohol as well. So this was a wooden city that was ready to burn, and burn it did during the beginning part of September.
Yeah, and obviously largely, as you said before, instigated by the very dry wood and the timber and that hot summer that had been before.
Yeah. And then also, I should say, there were also, as well as it being a hot summer and the place being built of wood, there was also a wind that was blowing the fire westward. So an easterly wind, which was kind of stoking the flames and helping it to spread further and further and further. And measures that should have perhaps been brought into place weren't taken. And by measures, I mean, usually when there was a fire, what would happen would be the surrounding buildings would be pulled down to kind of create a fire break so that the fire couldn't spread any further. But because this city was a city of tenants and landlords, permission was always needed to pull down a building. The only person that really could override this would be the mayor, but he would do it risking repercussions from landlords. So he was reluctant to do this. And perhaps if that had happened at the very beginning part of the fire, then it might not have been as great as it grew to be. But I mean, that's just conjecture.
So aside from that, what was the full effort to try and contain it?
So efforts were taken. At this point in time, you did have fire precautions. So I've mentioned the fire breaks, but there were other things as well that people had. So there was running water in pipes underneath most of the city, and these pipes would be opened up so that water could be obtained and put into fire engines. Now, obviously, I don't mean fire engines as we would understand them. They were basically carts with a big bucket at the top and a pump that would be used to squirt water onto the affected areas. So these were called for, but they couldn't fit down the tight streets and lanes of the central part of London. So they were kind of rendered redundant. But other things that people used would be sticks where they would pick and pull buildings apart, and water squirts as well. There's a few examples of these, or, you know, images of these on the Museum of London website, I believe. But we've certainly got buckets that were used to put out the fire. And there's one example in the Museum of London. So if you're listening and curious, go and have a look on their website, because you can see an original Great Fire bucket. Other than that, the mayor famously was thought to be rather useless. He kind of ran away, basically, and wasn't seen for the most part of the fire. And because of this, direct control for tackling the fire fell to those that were higher up in the hierarchy, which just so happened to be the king and his brother. So the king's brother, the Duke of York, was put in charge of putting out this fire, and he arranged for teams of men to be stationed at various points around the city, and they would be attempting to put out the fire by creating fire breaks and squirting water and all of that business at various locations around the city, unsuccessfully for the most part.
Is it true that Charles II actually got sort of hands-on involved in trying to extinguish the fire?
Yeah, it is true. There are reports about him doing that. He went and got stuck in with everybody. He was seen, he made sure he was very visible and seen to be helping. I mean, there's reasons for this. It wasn't just because, you know, the city needed an extra pair of hands. Of course it did, but the king, you have to remember, had left London the year before when the Great Plague had happened. Now, why a king would remain in a city that was at risk, I don't know. I mean, it was probably the right decision to make. But that didn't mean that people still didn't think, oh, you know, why did he leave? He deserted us once. So he needed to be visible. He needed to make sure that the people of the city knew that he was involved in helping to tackle the fire. And he made sure that these endeavours and his efforts were written into the first edition of the London Gazette that came out after the fire, just so, you know, to make sure people were aware that he was involved as well.
Okay. So he did sort of use it as some kind of propaganda.
For sure, it was propaganda. As well, I mean, you know, it's human nature to want to help if you can see an emergency going on nearby. But yeah, it was certainly useful to him to have been involved and helped kind of, yeah, it was a useful and convenient thing for his propaganda machine.
What do you think that his involvement and his handling of the fire says about him as a king? Because he's known as the Merry Monarch. It's not sort of... He's not really popularly considered to be a king who would step up and actually get quite hands on with something as extreme as a fire. Is that conception of him not fair, do you think?
He's a very complex character, is our Charles II. He's a difficult one to pinpoint. I believe that he had been involved in, you know, lots of action earlier on in his life. He'd, you know, during the civil wars and after the civil wars, he'd attempted to win back his throne for his father and for himself. There's a famous, you know, story of him escaping dressed up and all of that, which I don't really need to go into right now. But, you know, he had been active in his youth and he was still, to be perfectly honest. But he does have this reputation. And part of it is to do with the fact that he'd opened the theatres when he'd returned following the restoration. He'd encouraged sports that had been banned before. So there was a sense of frivolity and a growing sense of things that people could do in their leisure time during the restoration period. So I think all of this has contributed into creating this almost stock character that we name Charles II. Of course, he was famous as well for having all of his mistresses and being quite open about it as well. That said, he was a very pragmatic man. He was intelligent as well, but he wasn't bookish, but he was intelligent and he knew how to use people. He knew how to tell people what they wanted to hear. So, yeah, I mean, he had to get involved in the fire. He was there. And if he hadn't, there would have been repercussions, because unlike any other monarch, probably before or after, he was very, very aware of the frailty of his position. His own father had had his head chopped off. Yeah, what does it say about Charles? I don't know. He's a bit, in terms of his personality and true thoughts, he is a bit of an enigma.
Yeah, absolutely. And you're right. He had to show face because of the situation his father found himself in.
Yeah, exactly.
How exactly was the fire finally extinguished?
Well, it wasn't. I mean, it extinguished itself. It burnt as much as it could. There were areas where fire breaks did help to halt the spread of the fire. So the River Fleet, which was still in existence then, it did kind of stop near to that area to the west of the city. But it did burn. I mean, it just burnt itself out. There was nothing from the efforts of the fire, those fighting the fire, that really helped to end it. But it, you know, it had taken several days for this to happen. And even, you know, months after, you get reports in Pepys's diary, and he's saying that there are still areas of the city that are still smoking. So, yeah, it wasn't through any human effort that it was extinguished.
So how, you say it sort of ended at near to the River Fleet, how far did it spread, and what was the extent of its destruction?
So the fire mainly was concentrated within the city of London. So this is the walled city, and the scale of the destruction, I mean, you can look at maps of the city following the fire, and it's around about 80% of the city of London that was destroyed as a result. Now, when you look down at a map, you kind of get the sense that things have been flattened. Well, that's not the case. It wasn't a levelled city. There were still buildings there and, you know, debris and shells of larger buildings. So it was a dangerous place to be navigating and walking around. There were lots of huge casualties of the fire. Places like St Paul's Cathedral, which famously was destroyed. Also, people had stored lots of stuff within St Paul's Cathedral because it was one of the few places that was actually made out of stone. So they thought that their goods and belongings would be safe. The book trade stored lots of, I mean, the booksellers stored lots of their things there. And it's estimated that they lost around £200,000 worth of stock as a result. The city as a whole, and this is in contemporaneous money, the city as a whole, it's thought that it probably lost around 10 million. But, I mean, there were people that lost individually. So you get accounts of people weeping because of their, you know, their homes being in ashes. You get people wandering around from the ruins, just picking up the remains of their homes and things. So, yeah, it was extensive within the city of London.
Gosh, that's just awful. And I think St Paul's Cathedral was historically such a tragedy within the Great Fire. There's so much history lost within that cathedral, and incredible tomb monuments and everything.
Yeah, I mean, if you go to the St Paul's, which famously was built by Sir Christopher Wren afterwards, you go to the cathedral, and if you're... Actually, I don't know if you're allowed to see this as a regular visitor, but I was lucky enough to go behind the scenes a little bit a few years ago. And they do still have some of the stones and remains of the old cathedral hidden away there. And it's fascinating to see these remnants of
really?
Yeah, they've got them.
I had no idea.
Yeah, I mean, there's not loads of them, but they are just kind of stored away in, I was going to say a loft, but it's probably a bit more extravagant than a loft. But it's in a random room that I went into, and you can see these bits and pieces there.
Oh, wow. I'd love to see that. That'd be fascinating. Okay, so Christopher Wren, he was really responsible for everything that happened after the fire.
Well,
how did he reshape London? Or not Christopher Wren, others as well?
Well, yeah, he was made master of the work. So he was in charge of rebuilding, designing and then managing the rebuilding of many of the churches. They didn't rebuild all of them. There were, to be honest, probably too many churches in London anyway. But he was in charge of that, but he was supported by a team of experts as well. So Robert Hooke was directly involved in the rebuilding project, and there were lots of people that had, you know, ideas about how London should look afterwards. And many, I mean, one thing that you don't have a shortage of in Restoration London are men that claim to be polymaths. So there were lots of men submitting new maps and ideas to Charles II for how the city could look. And there were varying degrees of intricacy. So John Evelyn, he created one which was, you know, quite nice, as did Christopher Wren. Robert Hooke created a map. We don't know what that looked like, but apparently the mayor and the alderman really liked that one. But there was one guy, and his name's escaped me now, and he submitted a map, and it's literally just straight lines across a page, which he thought would be the streets. But in the end, because of the way that the city was made up, as I've already said, it was a city of landlords and tenants. The king didn't own all of the land there. The mayor didn't own all of the land. It was owned by individuals. So it pretty much was rebuilt with the same street layout and things. It was just certain rules were brought into place that buildings had to be made of stone or clad in stone, or brick, I should say, and the streets were widened and that kind of thing.
At this point, because there was actually, what a lot of people don't know is there were more rivers than the River Thames. Were they visible at this point, or did this redesign of London actually... Was that responsible for covering them up?
Yeah, they were visible, and some of them were just stinking, boggy kind of sewers. So I mentioned the River Fleet. After the Great Fire, there was instructions for that to be turned into a kind of canal rather than a messy river that it was, but there were still reports decades later in the early 18th century of how much the River Fleet just stank. So there were rivers and things, and there was an effort made to make places, to make it just a bit cleaner and neater, because they knew that it would prevent further fires. Also, I should also say that trades that encouraged smoke and things were encouraged to move out of the City of London, so that, you know, the risk of fire was reduced as well.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
So you briefly mentioned Samuel Pepys, and he is one of many, I want to say chroniclers, but that's probably not the right terminology for this period. So he's one of the many colourful accounts of this period. What did he have to say about the fire and also others?
Pepys is funny during the Great Fire, so he takes great pride in telling the king that there's a fire going on, and he's led to believe, or at least he believes himself, that he was the first person to tell the king. But again, I think this is just Charles making him feel important. But then he details everything that's going on in, you know, graphic detail. We learn about pigeons trying to escape buildings, but their wings being burnt. And we see, you know, he writes about women raiding barrels of sugar and pouring sugar into beer and all of this after the fire. So there's loads and loads of detail packed into his account. But the one thing Pepys doesn't seem to do during the Great Fire is actually help. He doesn't. There's nothing. I mean, it's been a while since I've gone through every single sentence of his diary, but I don't think there's any occasion where he actually helps. He just talks about other people. He helps himself. Like, he leaves, you know, gets his goods removed from his house and, you know, and he climbs up a church to have a look around. But yeah, he doesn't get in and, you know, fight the fire himself, although he does tell the king about it.
Okay. I love Samuel Pepys.
Yeah, I
his
know.
Diary.
He's horrible. He's horrible.
His diary, just brilliant.
Yeah.
And was there anybody else that sort of did have some more first-hand accounts of the fire that suffered arguably more than Pepys?
So yes, there's a really lovely account of a young boy. It was written when the boy was a man later on and printed a lot later. But there was a young boy named William Taswell that attended Westminster School. So he was at Westminster Abbey in the morning of the Great Fire and heard about the fire because there was commotion at the back of the abbey. And then all the boys kind of went out to have a look at what was going on, and they saw boats kind of moving westward filled with goods and things. And then they learned about the fire. They were sent... These young boys were sent over to the east of the city, and they helped aid the fight against the fire. So they were stationed. Well, he was by the Tower of London, helping the men there that were trying to put out the fire, because obviously the worst scenario would be if the fire reached the Tower of London, because the Tower of London was full of artillery at the time, gunpowder and that kind of thing. So he did actually help, and his account is, you know, fairly detailed, not as detailed as Pepys, but it is detailed. Then if you look in the state papers, you can see letters from people and petitions from people that have lost their livelihoods. So there's various people that claim that they've lost, you know, £5,000, £6,000 worth of their goods and, you know, there's lots of material there. And also John Evelyn, another one that just seems to watch the fire from afar, he gives a fairly detailed account of what was going on as well.
And you talk about the evidence in the state papers. Once the fire was extinguished, what was the human response to the loss and the tragedy of the fire?
Well, it's hard to gauge the human cost. I mean, I've mentioned some of the individual accounts. So people did lose out financially. Some people left the city altogether. Many returned to the area where their homes and businesses had once existed and tried to set up kind of temporary shacks and things. But this was banned quite quickly, actually, and they had to wait for their shops to be re-established properly. But then there's the psychological impact as well. And there are many accounts of how people had kind of internalised the events of the Great Fire, but also the plague as well. And Pepys writes in his diary about having nightmares months and months afterwards. There's another account of a gentleman saying that the memory of this event will stay with them for the rest of their lives. And you can understand why, because it was such a huge fire. We can't even really, I mean, I've experienced fires myself, and quite a, you know, during my childhood, there was a very large fire at the end of the street where I grew up. And it was huge. And, you know, just the orangeness of it all and the blackness of the smoke, all of central London on fire. You cannot even fathom what that must have looked like. So it did stay with people.
That must have been terrifying. And what did people blame it on? Did they think that it was some kind of divine retribution, or were they quite practical about it?
They did both, actually. One of the interesting things about this time is that people were able to both be reasonable and understand that it was probably a human act, but also consider it to be divine retribution for their sins. Thomas Farrinder clearly was the man that caused the fire, or at least his family was, but the blame was put onto a Frenchman who actually confessed to doing it, and he was executed for starting the fire. But they blamed the Dutch, and during the Great Fire, there were really violent xenophobia broke out towards anyone that was viewed to be foreign. So people that were living in London and spoke with any kind of accent that didn't seem English were at risk, and they hid away. And in some instances, they were incarcerated. I think one of the quotes, I think it's from the Earl of Clarendon, he said that during times like this, it's better for them to lose their liberty rather than their safety. There was a lot of blame going around. And you can see it whenever, I mean, we're living through a situation that's really odd at the moment. And you can see how people try to blame others or latch onto things so that they can project their own fears onto others, so that it kind of gives a physical face to what we can't really explain.
I think it's very human. I know, looking a few centuries prior to this, there was exactly the same thing happened during the Great Revolt in 1381.
Yeah.
Anyone in foreign or spoke with a foreign accent in London was targeted and treated appallingly. And it's really interesting that, you know, you go forward to that 1666 and that's still happening.
But isn't it sad? Isn't it sad, Helen, that we know this? We know that disaster and disease goes hand in hand with xenophobia and racism. We know that it's happened historically, yet it still happens today. We don't seem to learn those lessons, and I don't know. I fear that we never will. And it's one of the things that is just breaking my heart about the situation we're in, that is happening as well. But I know this isn't a conversation about coronavirus, but, you know, it's in my mind, it's in your mind as well. And any conversation about a historical disaster, it's hard not to draw parallels with today.
We were talking about it before we started the podcast, weren't we? And talking about how, you know, you can you know, in many cases you can't sort of, history does repeat itself. And you can apply the same principles but look at them differently.
Yeah, yeah, you can.
Anyway, looking sort of for traces of the fire, obviously it destroyed so much of the city of London. Where survived? Where endured?
Well, there's very little, unfortunately, within the city of London that survived. The Guildhall is knocking about still. That was damaged, so you can see that. Then everything to the west of the city, so not St Paul's, that's the wrong religious space. Westminster Abbey, that's obviously still there. It was never really affected by the fire at all, and all of that area. But there's one place that is pre-fire that exists within the city of London, and it's brilliant, and it's called the Old Wine Shades, and it's a little pub that was actually a merchant's house before the Great Fire, but it's a pub now, and you can go there and get some nice wine, and I would highly recommend it. It's very historic, very dark, but it's nice.
I think we should do that when we're allowed out.
Yes, we should.
Okay. And is there anywhere else that you would recommend that people go to just to see some traces of 1666, in London or elsewhere?
Well, Waterstones, and pick up a copy of my book. You can see some lovely images there.
Or you can get it on Amazon.
Yes, or any other online retailer. No, seriously, traces of the fire. Do you know what? The best place to go is the Museum of London, because you can see lots of objects there, and they have a permanent exhibition about the plague and the Great Fire, and it's fascinating, and it's the things and the artifacts that they've got are brilliant. So I would recommend going there and then going to the Old Wine Shades afterwards for a glass of wine or a beer to you know, reflect on what you've seen.
It's a date. I love both the Museum of London and I like wine. So
perfect.
Oh, well, thank you so much for coming on the podcast, Rebecca. You're working really hard on so many different things. So you've got, let's talk about HistFest, which was unfortunately postponed. Mm. When are people hopefully going to be able to buy tickets for the next round?
So it's been postponed, but it is going to happen in September. Touch wood, please touch wood, everybody. But it's going to happen on the 19th and 20th of September, and we've got a pretty much intact lineup. There's only one casualty with the move, but we're hoping to do something a special event anyway. So you can get tickets to that. I think you can get them now. If not, just check out histfest.org and all of the information will be on there. But in the meantime, while you're in lockdown, I've put up some videos. We had a mini online festival, so there's some videos on the HistFest YouTube channel, which you can have a look at as well.
Amazing. And you've also excitingly got your own podcast coming out soon.
Yes, I have. The first episode, I'm hoping, is going to be out this week, and it's called Killing Time, and it's a look at the darker parts of history to shine a light on the wider social repercussions of historical crime and macabre incidents.
Amazing. I'm certainly going to be subscribing to that. And then lastly, you're also working on your next book.
An ongoing process about the Stuarts. I can give you the title. It's called God's Throne, and it is going to be a narrative history of the Stuart dynasty.
Brilliant.
I'm hoping it'll be good.
Well, everybody, keep your eye out for that, and I'm sure that it will be out fairly soon.
Yes, at some point this century.
It's hard. Writing a book is really hard. It's really, really hard.
It is.
So, you know what? Anybody who can do it, anyone who does it, we should all take our hats off to them, because it's a tough process and it takes a really long time.
I'm taking my hat off to you as well, Helen, because I know you're doing the same thing.
Yeah, we'll get there in the end, and then we'll go to that nice pub.
Yes, we'll do it. I think we have to go before that point, to be honest.
Oh, well, thanks so much, Rebecca, and I will certainly be having you on the podcast again soon, hopefully, to talk about your new book when it's out.
Great. Thank you.